Okay, hello everybody.
Okay, Rabbi, nice to see you. Okay, I apologize. Okay, I'm just going to make you co-host, and I'm going to welcome you. Thank you very much, and say your lecture is being sponsored by Rabbi Meir Bruckheimer in celebration of the anniversary of his bar mitzvah yesterday, Parshas Pekudei, and in loving memory of his wife Hindel Bat Eliakim HaKohen. Zalmay, have long life and good health. Rabbi Angel, a pleasure to welcome you. Rabbi Angel is the national scholar for the Institute of Jewish Ideas and Ideals. He's been teaching Bible Tanakh at Yeshiva University since 1996 and is a prolific author. And we'll give you 2 extra minutes to go over time, okay?
Thank you so
Bakasha.
much, Rabbi Kelman.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so thank you so much. It's really a wonderful thing to be part of this program, and thank you to Rabbi Kelman and to Torah in Motion in general, and to all of you for coming from probably all over the world, which is amazing. Okay, so here's the 30-minute crash course in Megillat Esther, where I'll tell you, I teach at Tanakh Yeshiva University and all over adult education, and I find the Megillah the hardest book to teach of all of them. And the reason is that no matter where I go, there's all this baggage that people have from the time they are 4. And however they learned it, they come in with an amazing series of assumptions. And for the record, none of them are in the Megillah. And the result is that when I try to teach the Megillah, it's shockingly complicated to undo. So what I do when I have a full course in Megillat Esther, I spend an entire shiur, an entire lecture, taking the top 5 assumptions that everybody has, shooting them to smithereens, and just telling my students, okay, let's start at ground zero and then build up. That's really the only way to do it. In a 30-minute rendition, I'm simply going to say the conclusions of that and then try to do the building part, because I think that'll be a more productive way to go. One thing that's amazing is that the Jews in Megillat Esther, you could read it yourself today, tomorrow, on Purim, twice, however you'd like to do it. The Jews are absolutely good. They are the most positively depicted Jewish community you find pretty much in the entire Tanakh. It's amazing. They mourn and they fast. They always listen to their leaders. You talk to the prophets about how often people listen to them. It's not often. They're usually rather frustrated at all of this. When they win the battles after fighting a united front against really wicked, evil people who are trying to destroy them, they're good to one another. They take care of the poor. They take care of one another. All the mitzvot that we have now as laws derive from the spontaneous goodness of the people of Israel. The Megillah even stresses they actually had permission to plunder their enemies after they won, but 3 times over, the Megillah stresses that they did not. I think one of the most curious testaments to how righteous the Jews are during the Megillah is in source number 1, which I saw that Rabbi Kelman just posted it, and I hope that that still is the case. I hope that you all have the source sheets. It says sources are here. That is very encouraging. In source number 1, I'm just going to read the English, but you have the Hebrew as well. When Haman accuses us, what does he say? Haman then said to King Ahasuerus, "There is a certain people scattered and dispersed among the other peoples in all the provinces of your realm, whose laws are different from those of any other people and who do not obey the king's laws. It is not in your majesty's interest to tolerate them." The whole accusation is that our laws are different and that the Jews follow a different system. So I don't want to put too much stock in anything Haman says. He's a really evil, wicked guy. But it's still critical to note that his whole point is that he says that somehow we stand out with our own integrity. And one midrash picks up on that in source number 2 in a collection called Esther Rabbah. For every charge which Haman brought against them below, Michael, who's officially in midrashic literature, the guardian angel of Israel who defends Israel against enemies in the heavenly court, pleaded a defense for them above. He said, "Sovereign of the universe, your sons are being accused not because they have worshipped idols, nor because they have shed blood, but solely because they have kept your laws." So this midrash picks up on what is true. In Megillat Esther, the Jews are incredibly good. In fact, the only sign of foreign influence that they have are the names Mordechai and Esther. Those are pagan names. Certainly Mordechai is. It's after the god Marduk. I'm going to have to explain that to my own son Mordechai one day, but he's only 9, so let's give him a little time. Right now, it's just he's named after his grandfather, and they're both named after the the Megillah hero, that's good enough for now. But at some point, we have to learn that this is a tremendously pagan name that became Jewish because of the Megillat Esther story. And Esther, it's debated whether it refers to Ishtar or just Star. But either way, it's not a specifically Jewish name. It's a pagan name. And I don't think that, I hope that you don't think, but I don't think anyway, that their foreign names suggest assimilation of them or of the Jewish people at all. Simply in all communities, Jews have sometimes taken on names of their hosts, and there's no exception here at all. So that's all we have. The only reason, according to Megillat Esther, that the Jews deserve to be destroyed has nothing to do with sin or assimilation or anything. There's one reason given why the Jews are in trouble, and that's because Mordechai refuses to bow to Haman, and that ticks him off. He gets really upset, and obviously Haman has very serious problems that predate Megillat Esther, the story that we have, where he reacts not only by wanting to kill Mordechai, which actually is a reasonable response from a king's high official in Persia. I mean, I don't like it, but it's reasonable within their laws. But the idea of exterminating the entire Jewish people obviously goes beyond what you or I or probably Mordechai expected would happen as a result of Mordechai's refusal. But that's the only reason that the Jews are in danger, and that's something that we need to think about, because amazingly, Megillat Esther, here's another thing it doesn't explain. Not only what is the theological reason behind the Jews, the threat of the Jewish people, but why in the world did Mordechai not bow? What's wrong with bowing to Haman? You're allowed to bow to a king in Tanakh. In fact, even Natan the prophet bows before David HaMelech, and I guarantee you, David was not offended and say, how can a Jew bow to a person? He's not worshiping him. He's showing sign of respect. And the same thing would be true when Mordechai bows to Haman. In fact, in Megillat Esther, you can look it up yourself. In chapter 8, Esther bows to her husband, Ahasuerus, to plead on behalf of the Jewish people in the Megillah. And that's fine. That's perfectly normal. And nobody thinks anything, oh my goodness, how can Esther bow to a human being? The answer is it's a sign of respect, and there's nothing wrong with that. And so the idea that Mordechai would even risk his own life, let alone what turns out to be the life of his entire people, is stunning and very surprising. And we have no explanation given in Megillat Esther for why that should be. If you look at source number 4, somebody is, by the way, Rabbi Kelman, it says here, please show sources again.
Well, they're asking you if you want to share your screen, unless you're uncomfortable. I know some people don't like to do that. I'll leave that to you as the speaker. But if you don't mind, you can share your screen with the people. Otherwise, I ask people just to click on the source there and you can see the sources or go to the website. So that's really up to you, Rabbi Angel.
I'm happy to do that. Hold on one moment. Okay. I'm doing it as we speak. Okay.
Thank you. Alas,
now I can see you very little. I can see Rabbi Kelman. So that's good.
That's why some people
don't
like it.
That's why I don't like it, but I want to make sure that everybody sees it. That's more important.
Right.
Here you go to source number 4. All the king's courtiers in the palace gate knelt and bowed low to Haman, for such was the king's order concerning him. But Mordechai would not kneel or bow low. Then the king's courtiers who were in the palace gate said to Mordechai, why do you disobey the king's order? When they spoke to him day after day and he would not listen to them, they told Haman, in order to see whether Mordechai's resolve would prevail, for he explained to them that he was a Jew. Okay, so we don't even know from this passage if Mordechai's Jewishness is why Mordechai does not bow. It's incredibly unclear. But what I can tell you is that I have no clue why he's not bowing. In fact, it's so unclear that source number 5 in another midrash in the collection called Esther Rabbah, was Mordechai then looking for quarrels or disobedient to the king's command? The fact is that when Ahasuerosh ordered that all should bow low to Haman, the latter fixed an idolatrous image on his breast for the purpose of making all bow down to an idol. This is amazing. The midrash is saying the only thing that you have in the text is that Mordechai was trying to be disobedient to the king, but why should that be? So they say, Haman must have had an idol on his lapel or something like that. In which case, okay, we now understand why a Jew would give his life not to bow down to an idol. But that answer is entirely outside of the text. Here are some other things that are outside of the text. Where is God's name? Where is anything about Jewish observance? There's nothing about Torah, Shabbat, anything specifically Jewish other than our nationality. The Jews are in danger. We know nothing about our observance at all. So these are the things that we don't know. We don't know why the Jews should deserve destruction. We don't know why Mordechai refuses to bow. We don't know what the state of Jewish observance is other than the Jews are depicted entirely positively. This is what I like to think of as a lack of control. We lose our control. Once we forego the midrashic assumptions that build at least my picture of what I used to think the Megillah was about, and many others do also, we have to start thinking about, okay, so what does the Megillah teach? So I happen to be blessed with really terrible eyesight. So I've been to ophthalmologists many times where they say, what looks better, A or B? Anybody bespectacled among you knows the same thing. You go through this drill many, many times. So that's one approach. And I think of learning very often just like that, that you have a certain picture and then you learn something new and all of a sudden you have a refined picture of the text. And that's great. In this particular case, I read one article a few years back. It was by somebody named David Henschke. It was in Megadim, the Orthodox Tanakh journal that comes out of Israel, Megadim. And Rabbi Henschke wrote a 12-page or so article in Hebrew. I read it a couple of times and realized everything I ever thought about the Megillah was simply not in the Megillah. And he gave me a whole new insight. So today, very briefly, I'm going to summarize some of his conclusions, along with just other points along the way. It's not just him, but without him, I never would have been able to get out of it. So here's where I was taught wrong. Silly me, I thought for many years that the story of Megillat Esther is primarily the battle of Mordechai, Esther, and the Jews against Haman and his evil allies. And then when the Jews beat Haman and his evil allies, then that's good. That's why we have Purim, right? Okay, all excellent, except it doesn't explain very important chunks of the Megillah. For example, chapter 1 of Megillat Esther, Ahasuerus is king, and he throws two fabulous parties. Good for him. Kings throw parties. They're going to invite the governors. They're going to invite their local townsfolk. And they're going to be, make lavish parties because he's an emperor of this vast empire. But you still have to sort of kind of like wonder, who needs that? Why in the world would Tanakh include a whole chapter in intricate detail about the king's parties? If you and I were writing the Megillah, all we would need to do is like this. Once upon a time, there was King Ahasuerus of Persia. He needed a new wife. And so his advisor said, hey, have a beauty contest. And they get Esther, who needs the whole Vashti thing, and who needs the whole what fabrics were in the palace and how long these parties were. None of that has any role to play in the story of Mordechai, Esther, and the Jews against Haman and his allies. And easily the most anticlimactic verse probably in all of Tanakh, but certainly in Megillat Esther. So the Jews fight for their lives. They fight an extra day in Shushan. They win the war. We have a holiday called Purim. We have all these great mitzvot that we observe. The end. I'm waiting for the end. And then source 7 rolls in. This tiny little chapter, chapter 10. King Ahasuerus imposed tribute on the mainland and the islands. Now look, kings do tax their subjects. I'm not surprised that Ahasuerus taxed his subjects. But who cares? Why in the world do we have to have this after happily ever after the end, and now we have the holiday called Purim? That's where you stop the Megillah. So chapter 1 doesn't belong, chapter 10 doesn't belong, until you start to think like Rabbi Henschke, who says, you know what, we're missing the elephant on our sofa. The elephant on our sofa, it turns out, is Ahasuerus. He is not just an important character in the Megillah, he is the important character in the Megillah. And the Megillah never tires of emphasizing this. When we think about Mordechai and Esther, I'm sorry to say, as much as I love them, and I really, really do, Esther is the queen. Wow, what a powerful person. No, she's not, and nor does she think so. You know, Mordechai's like, come on, you got to go in. The Jews are in danger. You have to plead to your husband on behalf of our people. All she could say is, excuse me, but don't you realize that my husband may kill me? She knows how small she is, even though she's the queen of Persia, right? All the king's courtiers, source 8, and the people of the king's provinces know that if any person, man or woman, enters the king's presence in the inner court without having been summoned, there's but one law for him, that he be put to death. Only if the king extends the golden scepter to him may he live. Now, I have not been summoned to visit the king for the last 30 days. She knows where she stands, and let me just remind everybody, Esther is just the new Vashti. Look what happened to her. She declined a king's request. The king got angry and, well, she's now done. Well, Esther knows that she is no more secure than that. And the same thing with Mordechai. It's very nice that at the end, Haman is killed and Mordechai sort of replaces him. But Mordechai is just the next Haman in terms of position. So the same thing could happen to him. And Mordechai is totally aware of that. If you look at source 11 for a second, when Haman is killed even, they impaled Haman on the stake which he had put up for Mordechai, and the king's fury abated. It's absolutely amazing. I apologize. Okay. It's amazing that our arch enemy is killed at the end of chapter 7, but you know what? What's the Jewish reaction to that? Nothing. Because the Jews don't care about Haman. Haman is really wicked. He is as bad as you think he is. But even when he's dead, the Jews understand what you and I understand too, which is there's nothing to celebrate here because we're still going to be killed on the 13th day of Adar. So the Jews understand that Haman also is useless. At the end of the day, what's the point of the Megillah? Everybody is playing on the king's stage. The king absolutely makes people rise or fall. At the beginning, Vashti and Haman are sitting tall, and by the end, they're no longer. And right now, at the end of the Megillah, Esther and Mordechai are riding high, but we all know that theoretically, the king's mood could change at any moment, and that would be their end also. And so all of a sudden, chapter 1 and chapter 10 are not marginal tangential points. The whole Megillah is about the king's honor, glory, and power. And everybody else is playing on Ahasuerus's stage. And suddenly everything falls into place. Esther knows that, Mordechai knows that, the Jews know that, Haman knows that, or by the end of it, he realizes what has just happened to him. Okay, then we move on to the next phase. Where did God go in the Megillat Esther? The answer is, here's a shocking point, Ahasuerus is occupying the biblical role that Hashem normally plays in a book in Tanakh. Ahasuerus dominates this Megillah. Everything plays on his stage. Any other biblical book, everybody plays on God's stage. What's wacky about Megillat Esther is that the whole book is just 167 verses long. That's it. The word Hamelech, or related king words, talking about Ahasuerus, that word appears some 200 times. If you are mathematically inclined, that means that averaging more than one time per verse. That's crazy. God's name doesn't even appear that frequently on average in Tanakh, and it appears quite a lot. And then when you have Hashem, it appears zero times, you start to get it. Ahasuerus is playing the role on which everybody normally plays on God's stage in Tanakh. That's the whole point. Not today. In Megillat Esther, Ahasuerus occupies God's role, which is very depressing, by the way, but it gets worse. His palace replaces the Beit HaMikdash in Yerushalayim. So much so that if I just give you this wonderful scenario, by the way, this is the point that convinced me that this is the right way to read the Megillat Esther. If you just picture, the leader of the Jewish people is fasting, and all the Jews are fasting too. The leader of the Jewish people is about to enter a sacred throne room at pains of death to plead on behalf of the Jewish people. What am I describing? Under normal circumstances, I'm describing Yom Kippur. The Kohen Gadol is fasting. All the Jews are fasting. The Kohen Gadol will enter the throne room of God, the Kodesh Kadashim, the Holy of Holies in Jerusalem, in the temple, to plead on behalf of the people of Israel. But in Megillat Esther, it's Esther is fasting, all the Jews are fasting. Esther goes into King Ahasuerus's throne room at pains of death to plead on behalf of her people. That point, to me at least, is so strong that it sounds like that's the point of Megillat Esther. Ahasuerus has replaced God. His palace has replaced the temple in Jerusalem. And then you start thinking about the party. What's the vision of the prophets? One of the most celebrated way, I always am ashamed that it's outside of the United Nations, which pretty much, I can go into clinical detail if I had more time, does not live up to what its Isaiah wall claims that it does, but I still like what it says on the Isaiah wall, which is in source 12, and the many people shall go and say, come, let us go up to the mount of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may instruct us in his ways, that we may walk in his paths. For instruction shall come forth from Zion, the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. Yes, that's what should be happening. All the nations of the world will see the righteous people of Israel living in Israel, a built temple, representing the finest in religious morality ever possible. And all the nations of the world are flooding into Jerusalem to celebrate that and to live that life. Instead, we open up Megillat Esther, and what's happening? All the nations of the world are flooding to the king's palace to have a lavish feast, to drink a lot, and for all, and that's it. It's a killer. I don't know about you. I find this, the shiur really gets me agitated, because Megillat Esther is letting us know that Ahasuerus and his palace have completely eclipsed the vision of what Tanakh is supposed to be about, which is God is in the middle and all the nations of the world are accepting Hashem and living that moral life. Okay. So the irony of the Megillah is the Ahasuerus that we all do know. This guy who's supposed to be, who's standing in God's way is a drunk, bumbling fool who has no moral value whatsoever. He's willing to sell a nation into genocide to make a lot of money. To be sure, it is a lot of money, but that shows that he has no morality at all. He is amoral. And in fact, that's the kind of guy that he is. Haman represents Amalek. He is immoral. He is a truly wicked, evil person who wants to exterminate the Jewish people. Ahasuerus and Megillat Esther could not care less about the Jews. For him, it's a business deal. Haman says, look, I'm giving you more money than you could possibly get from Jewish tax revenue. Let me kill them. And Ahasuerus is like, okay, here's my signet. Go do what you need to do. Let's drink a l'chaim. Ahasuerus doesn't hate us. He just wants to benefit himself and his empire. And all of a sudden, everything else falls into play about what the Megillah is trying to do. Mordechai saves the king's life from two people named Bigtan and Teresh, two king's officials. And what is his reward? Nothing. The king does nothing. They write it in a book, and that comes in handy years later. But at the time, he does nothing to reward Mordechai. And then the very next pasuk, instead, he promotes Haman for no reason giving in Megillat Esther. When he parades Mordechai around in chapter 6, it's so fun. I love that scene. Haman is parading him around. He's totally mortified to be parading around his hated enemy to the cheers of Shushan. But you and I should know that Mordechai is still threatened by the king's decree. It's very nice that the king is showing him a lot of honor, but he's going to be killed, so far as anybody knows, on the 13th day of Adar by virtue of the king's decree. And so Chazal, our sages in the Talmud, pick up on all of these things. They realize Ahasuerus is not a neutral character at all. If you look at source 14, when Esther finally turns Haman over, thereupon King Ahasuerus demands of the Queen Esther, who is he and where is he who dared to do this? Who would dare kill you and your people? The adversary and enemy, replied Esther, is this evil Haman. And Haman cringed in terror before the king and queen. And we're all like, yeah, you're going down, Haman. One Gemara in Masechet Megillah, in Tractate Megillah, sees through that scene, though. And it very graphically, in a midrashic way, talks about it in source 15. Esther said, the adversary and enemy is this evil Haman. Rabbi Elazar said, this informs us that she was pointing to Ahasuerus, and an angel came and pushed her hand so as to point to Haman. This is a great midrashic way of framing the whole thing. But what is the Gemara saying in our language? Ahasuerus is the real culprit. Without him, there is no Haman. He's the one who promoted Haman. He's the one who authorized Haman to do whatever he wants with his signet. Had Ahasuerus, for example, said, sorry, Haman, I appreciate all this money, but we don't exterminate people in my empire. We are moral people here. We have real laws. We have a backbone. And you're fired or about to be executed. How dare you suggest that you're going to exterminate these perfectly law-abiding, peaceful people in my empire, right? That's Ahasuerus's failure. And without that failure, Haman never would be able to have the power to do what he does. And source number 16 frames it very nicely. Don't think that Ahasuerus is nicer at the end of the Megillah. Yes, now he's good to the Jews, so it works out well. He supports Esther, promotes Mordechai. It all sounds like he's better. So source 16 says, no, he's not. That is Ahasuerus. That means that he persisted in his wickedness from beginning to end. This is completely correct. Ahasuerus is no more moral at the end, meaning hypothetically, if another person shows up with another huge bribe, the Jews will be in danger again. So why did Mordechai not bow, according to this analysis? Because he's fighting two battles. Haman is evil, So Mordechai will never bow down before evil. But Ahasuerus is amoral, and Mordechai will never bow down before anybody who is amoral either, because Mordechai is religious and moral. There are two fights that he's fighting, and there are two fights that Megillat Esther is fighting. One fight is Haman is really evil, and Baruch Hashem, he didn't make us dead. He wanted to kill all of us, but failed. Hashem helped us behind the scenes. That's great. That's battle one. That's the surface battle. But the deeper battle is that God is battling against Ahasuerosh. There's amorality, and when you have amorality and power, then Amalek can always rise. And then there's morality represented by God and the temple in Jerusalem, which represent Haman's can never get off the ground as long as there's moral backbone in the world. And Source 17 very colorfully depicts that one. Now when Mordechai knew all that was done, what was his cry? Rav said, he said, Haman has raised himself above Ahasuerosh. So Rav takes the surface meaning of the Megillah. Mordechai was upset because Haman now has the ring and the Jews are threatened with annihilation from Haman. Shmuel said, the upper king has prevailed over the lower king, which as Rashi quickly explains, the opposite. It means that, oh no, Ahasuerosh has defeated God. This Talmudic passage captures the two layers of the Megillah beautifully. The surface layer, which is what I learned as a kid, Haman got power and threatened the Jews, and we celebrate that he is gone. But the deeper level of the Megillah is the whole Ahasuerosh piece that we've been talking about. For a while, oh no, Ahasuerosh is prevailing over God. So what happens in the Megillah? The Jews beat Haman, which is why we have a holiday. But then that anticlimactic verse that we saw way earlier, scrolling on back, source number 7, King Ahasuerosh imposed tribute on the mainland and the islands. We didn't defeat Ahasuerosh. He's just as powerful as he was in chapter 1. Or another way to say it is, Baruch Hashem, the Jews are no worse off in the Megillah since we killed Haman and defeated the enemies. So we're still there, but we're actually no better off either. We're still under Ahasuerosh's thumb. The temple in Jerusalem still is not the center of the world. Shushan is. And that's the painful blow. And so the way our sages understand this, you go down to the very last source, is that Purim is actually, sorry to say, a crippled holiday. I don't want to dampen things too much. But Megillat Esther sets up Purim as a crippled holiday. On the one hand, we're very grateful to God that we're not dead. We're grateful that Haman was unable to do what he wanted to do. And we thank Hashem every year and celebrate that. It's a great thing to celebrate. We also celebrate, like the Jews of old, unified community, mishloach manot, matanot levyonim. We make sure that even the poor are included so everybody can celebrate this festive feast together as one. We read the Megillah. We thank God for all of these wonderful miracles. But Ahasuerosh still has too much power. And that's what Rava says. Yes, halachic question. Why don't we say Hallel on Purim? So the Talmud discusses other answers which have their own challenges, but I want to focus on Rava here in Source 18. Rava said, there is good reason in that case of the Exodus from Egypt, because it says in the Hallel, praise, O servants of the Lord, who are no longer servants of Paro. But can we say in this case, praise servants of the Lord and not servants of Ahasuerosh? We are still servants of Ahasuerosh. That is a very powerful line from Rava. And the whole point is that as long as Ahasuerosh still runs the world, new Hamans always can rise. And that's something that we need to think about. I am not thinking about any particular world leader today at all when I say the next line. You could plug this into your own political views. That's really not what I'm trying to do. That's never what I tried to do. When I teach Tanakh, I keep it pure, and your idea is we all apply it. We apply the principles as we see the world. But I'm not preaching any specific leader one way or the other here at all. Not in this country, not in Canada, not in any other place. At all. That as long as people like Ahasuerosh who are amoral and who don't have a strong moral background, but rather look out for their own self-gain, their own political gain, their own financial gain, or their own nation's gain, then Haman's can always rise because Ahasuerosh figured, okay, I can get more money from Haman than from Jewish tax dollars. Great. Here's the ring. Exterminate them if you like. Only when you have the world represented by Mordechai, Esther, and the Jews, and then behind the scenes, God and the Beit HaMikdash, when you have truly moral leaders who say that there is a basic moral standard we need to have at all times, and no amount of money can change that, and that's what the Megillah is about. That's the message of the Megillah. We need to stand tall and strong, like Mordechai, like Esther, and like the entire Jewish people, against not only immorality of Haman, but also amorality of Ahasuerus. With that, we did it. There's obviously a much longer version of that, but I want to leave a couple of minutes for Q&A. So what I'm going to do is stop screen saving, if I can. Come on. Stop share. Because then I can see you more and see all of these wonderful texts that have been popping in. Haman wanted to usurp the kingship, and Mordechai knew that. That's a very clever suggestion, and it might very well be right. All I can tell you is I don't know. I'm not disagreeing. I'm just saying I don't know that we know that from the Megillah, other than he seemed to be very inclined to, oh, when the king wants to honor somebody, I would love to wear that crown and the royal robes. I think there is that indication that perhaps you are right in that regard. That was Susanna Levin. I'm sorry if I'm not mispronouncing the name. We then have, doesn't Palace Gate indicate Mordechai was the equivalent to the head of the legal system? Palace Gate is where king's officers did assemble, which is why Haman walking through there has all the king's officials bowing down to him. But he's not the head of the legal system. In fact, it sounds like Mordechai just kind of crept into that gate of the king as a result of he wanted to be near Esther so he could communicate with her. That's how the story is set up. Doesn't sound like he received any royal appointment at that moment in the story.
I can't quote a source. However, I have heard such a suggestion from a good source, and that would explain what the problem was with Mordechai bowing down to Haman. Haman effectively is usurping the legal system to a certain extent. There had to be a legal system, and generally speaking, the judges sat at the gate.
For sure, this is correct. I can't agree or disagree. All I can tell you is that there's nothing in the Megillah that says that. But the Megillah doesn't say everything. There's no question that there are many backstories that one could create, whether head of the legal system, whether Haman wants to usurp the kingship. The shiur that I tried to present simply tried to scrape the Megillah down to its bare bones. What does it really say? And the idea that Ahasuerus plays such a monumental role, I think, is something that is often overlooked. I overlooked it myself till I read that article, and I felt that that was a life changer. Okay, this is brilliant. This is so relevant to today. Thank Rabbi David Henschke and whoever else I synthesized into that shiur. It's not just him, but without him, going back to the ophthalmology thing, I don't think I finished that sentence. To me, his article, at least to me, was like laser surgery. In fact, I'll tell on a personal note, when I taught Megillat Esther the first time at Yeshiva University, it was my fourth semester there, and I had all this great stuff to teach. I had spent all summer. I was so souped up. I couldn't wait to get there. And I was teaching a course in Megillot. So I started with Ruth, and Esther was next. And that's when I read, I'm constantly reading new things. And so I read Rabbi Henschke's article as the semester already had started. And I read it a couple of times and realized, oh my goodness, everything I'm about to teach, like starting next week, is wrong. And so I just deleted all of those files, because the rule is when you give a shiur, we all make mistakes, we know that, but you try to give the best shiur you can as of today. And I realized if I teach anything that I spent all summer and beyond developing, that would be misleading. So I just explained to my students what was going down. I said, okay, I had all this great stuff to teach you, but now I think it's all wrong. Not wrong. Wrong meaning there's nothing in the Megillah that supports anything I was planning on saying. So we're going to scramble together. So we scrambled. There was a big balagan. And by the next time around, I had it all sorted out. And so since then, it's been a lot easier to teach. But man, that was a life changer for me. That was the laser surgery. What leader of the ancient world was moral? Again, without going into any specifics about today, there aren't so many today either. There might be some, so keep that one open. But this is a constant world problem. And again, you apply it as you see fit based on who you like as world leaders and who you dislike. All I can tell you is that a moral backbone that involves no corruption and no monetary gain overruling basic principles of morality. I'm not talking about super moral here. I'm talking about basic, something that we crave in our elected officials and don't always get. Okay, that's all I can say. Okay, but Ahasuerus doesn't accept the money from Haman. I disagree. It's not 100% clear, but the bribe does come up a couple of times. You probably are referring to the expression in Hebrew, "Hakesef natun lach," the money is given to you, which could mean, no, thank you, I don't need your money. But it could just as well mean, as scholars have pointed out for quite some time, it's your money, do with it as you see fit. The fact that, time out, let's go to share screen again. Let's just, here are some sources that I passed over. No puns intended to any upcoming holidays. If you look at source 9 over here, Mordechai told him all that had happened to him and about all the money that Haman had offered to pay into the royal treasury. And then when Esther tells on Haman and reveals what's going on, "For we have been sold, my people and I, to be sold," get it? "To be destroyed, massacred, and exterminated. Had we been only sold as bondmen and bondwomen, I would have kept silent," etc. These two verses make it sound very strong that indeed, the king very much accepted the money, and that's the whole point of the Megillah. It's not 100%. Nothing is 100%, but I think that it's a far more likely reading of the thing. I assume that I'm very close to my end of time limit, and I know that it's a very tight schedule. I'll give you
45 seconds to go through the rest of the question.
Okay, quick. Who do you think wrote the Megillah? It's a good question, but we're not clear. We call it the Men of the Great Assembly. That keeps it open. It could have been Mordechai and Esther wrote the earliest version, as the Megillah itself says. If nothing is wrong in bowing because I'm on to make the decree, would he still – there's a question about, you know, it's a what if. Could Mordechai have anticipated that Haman would want to kill all the Jewish people? That's not at all clear. But he certainly knew he was putting his own life in danger by a public flouting of the king's decree. So I think that that's what's relevant to our thing. I don't have a link to Rabbi Henschke's article, but it's in the journal called Megadim. I think it's issue number 23. I don't know if it's translated into English. You could read my stuff about it because I write about it, but I don't have a link.
We just posted the link, so it's in this chat.
Oh, wonderful. Even better. Thank you, thank you, and thank you. So there you go. But it's definitely worth reading. It's a life changer. I mean, I gave you a synopsis of all of those things. Okay, so we got to the bottom of the page. I want to thank everybody. Thank you, Rabbi Kelman and Torah in Motion for having me and for being part of such a wonderful program. And I thank all of you for participating in it. And I hope that you will learn many, many other wonderful things throughout the course of the day. So Purim Sameach in advance and take care. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Angel. A pleasure. Thank you. Thank you. We'll take a 1 minute break. Miss Lori Novak, Yoetzet Halacha Lori, say hello. I know you're here. Thank you, Rabbi Angel. Okay, we'll take a 1 minute break. You can have your full allotment of time. We have our break, our 50-minute break will come after Lori's talk. So everybody stretch for 1 minute. I know I'm going to stretch for 1 minute, and then we'll be back and start. Okay.